No loans, no leases.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Borrowing money has slowed to a dribble. This morning we learned that applications for home loans are at their lowest level since 2000. Plus, banks aren't lending to each other, so the Federal Reserve stepped in again today. The Fed said it was extending an emergency borrowing program for Wall Street banks until January, and it announced a couple of other steps to loosen up the credit market. Car companies have decided leasing is a bad proposition. GMAC and Ford are both cutting back on auto leases. Chrysler has stopped them outright. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more from North Carolina Public Radio.
As the price of gas spikes up, the value of SUVs and pickup trucks has plummeted. That's a big problem for companies that leased these vehicles 2 or 3 years ago. They won't make nearly as much money selling the SUV or truck when that lease is up. Resale values on some trucks have dropped more than 30% over the last year. Brendan Moore runs the website autosavant.net. He says the losses for leasing companies are piling up.
You can do the math pretty quick, say $3,000 per vehicle, extrapolated over, you know, a million vehicles coming off lease, and you can see where they would lose a lot of money very quickly.
Ford took a $1.8 billion charge last quarter because of those lower resale values. Tight credit will also make leasing tougher. One bright side, though, Moore says companies that leased fuel-efficient cars are poised to make profits they didn't likely expect. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street might just get some momentum going after yesterday's rally. The Fed's announcement will help. Plus, there's a report that private employers added 9,000 jobs this month instead of 60,000 job cuts as expected. And the price of oil is still hovering around a two-month low. So far, the Dow is up another 122 points to 11,520. The NASDAQ has gained 9. The S&P 500 is up 11. In Asia today, stocks closed 1 to 2% higher, and European shares are up about the same amount so far. Oil is below $122 a barrel. Today, Congress takes up an issue of great importance to small businesses. There's a federal program that gives money to small companies for R&D, $2 billion a year. But the funding runs out in September unless Congress does something about it. Mitchell Hartman reports from our entrepreneurship desk.
CyberNet Systems in Ann Arbor, Michigan, used an award from the program to invent a robotic device the Army is now using in Kuwait. Heidi Jacobus is CEO.
So what we can do is recover from vast piles of returned ammunition, ammo that is good. That process had been done by hand.
But the House bill would also let high-tech and biotech companies that are owned by venture capital firms bid for the grants. Emily Mendel of the National Venture Capital Association says these are small businesses, too.
There is a common misperception that a company that receives venture capital backing has either, one, hit the jackpot, or two, is backed by a large corporation, neither of which are true.
Small business advocates counter that these firms already have plenty of access to R&D funding, and they'll muscle out true small-scale entrepreneurs. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Delta Airlines still isn't charging to check your first bag, but your second one? It's doubling the fee to $50 each way for domestic flights. A third bag is now $125. Travel light, my friend. Travel light. You're listening to the Morning Report for Wednesday, July 30th on Marketplace.org. The price of steel is somewhat higher, but not as much as steel company profits. Today, the world's largest steelmaker, ArcelorMittal, said profits more than doubled last quarter. This was actually a surprise. The company's share price has been falling because people assumed the slowing economy would hurt demand. Our European correspondent Stephen Beer joins us now. Stephen, so what's behind the big profits?
Well, the key issue seems to be that there is enough demand elsewhere to make up for the waning demand in the US, Europe, and Japan. As steel analyst Roger Manser told me, there's plenty of demand around the globe.
In the developing world, demand for steel is very strong at the moment for new railways, new ports, new stadiums, so that there is a global shortage in the steel market.
Okay, Stephen, so demand is strong in the developing world, but what about raw materials? How does the price of raw materials play into the price of steel?
It's had a big impact because the raw materials for making steel are a lot more expensive. Coking coal has gone up 200% over the past year. Iron ore has more than doubled. That fact was no doubt behind the news announced today that the mining giant Rio Tinto is expanding its iron ore mining in Brazil and putting an extra $2 billion in. So, yes, the raw materials have gone up in price too.
So analysts were surprised with these results, but what are people expecting for the next few months into next year?
Well, common sense suggests that steel prices will come down. Demand will slacken. After all, the Chinese will not be building quite so much infrastructure once the Olympics are over. However, ArcelorMittal is pretty confident. They say they're expecting demand to continue at these high levels well into next year. Analysts that I've been talking to, however, say that certainly in 2009 and 2010, prices will come down, but not, they say, collapse.
All right, Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Scott.
Do you know where the world's largest aquarium is? It's in Atlanta. It has more than 8 million gallons of water and 100,000 creatures. The Georgia Aquarium is only a couple years old, but already it's expanding. Why? Odette Youssef explains.
Atlanta is right near the top of any list for business conventions, but as a tourist destination, not so much. Some hope the aquarium will change that and bring business travelers back for fun. Augusta, Georgia resident Patty Cook may be evidence that it's working. On this peak Friday afternoon in the aquarium's food court, she settles into a table with her two granddaughters.
Well, we're on the way to my mother's, who lives in Columbus, so this was like a stop halfway to her house.
This is Cook's second visit to the Georgia Aquarium. She first came last year on a business trip. The man who built the aquarium believes others will also come back.
Georgia has never, ever been a tourist place.
Bernie Marcus, co-founder of Home Depot, which is based in Atlanta, opened the aquarium in 2005.
People would come here for conventions, and men would come by themselves, or the spouse would come by themselves, and then they'd get out of here. By the weekend, they'd be out of here. Today, they're bringing their families, and they're staying an extra day or two, and this adds to the economic impact.
But sustaining that economic impact is hard. Aquariums typically struggle to maintain the high ticket sales they see during their first year. Marcus hopes the pricey new dolphin wing, where you'll be able to swim with the marine mammals, will help the aquarium avoid that fate.
If you just stand with what you had, you cannot be successful. People just don't want to come back and see the same thing over and over. There are some that do, but most of them won't.
So is Marcus ready to invest $110 million every few years just to keep things fresh? He doesn't think it'll always take that much to bring people back. Georgia State University professor Bruce Seaman says the aquarium's pressure to innovate is getting lighter because other new attractions are opening nearby.
There's no doubt that having something like the aquarium, the new Cook Museum, the Children's Museum, this is helping slowly but surely to justify extending that stay an extra half day or an extra night.
It's also transforming downtown Atlanta. The Coca-Cola company poured $96 million into a revamped museum that opened last year next to the aquarium. And Georgia recently announced a new National Health Museum to be built nearby. In Atlanta, I'm Odette Youssef for Marketplace.
Here in Los Angeles, the city council is going after fast food joints. The council has passed a year-long ban on new fast food restaurants in South L.A. Renita Jablonski reports.
Resident Christine Jelks is waiting at a bus stop in South L.A. She can point to a McDonald's, KFC, Taco Bell, and El Pollo Loco.
We do need more healthy foods.
Nearly three-quarters of the restaurants in her neighborhood are fast food. Councilwoman Jan Perry says her constituents deserve more healthy options.
We are a community that is disproportionately affected by hypertension, heart disease, childhood obesity, morbid obesity, diabetes, you name it.
The moratorium on new fast food joints also includes incentives for grocery stores and sit-down restaurants to move in. Andrew Casagna with the California Restaurant Association says it's unfair to hold the restaurant industry responsible for a neighborhood's health.
If someone wants a cheeseburger or wants a burrito or a pizza, they're going to order that.
The ordinance still needs approval from the mayor. In Los Angeles, I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
Even the donut shop is going healthier. Dunkin' Donuts says next month it'll start offering flatbread sandwiches under 300 calories each. I don't know who's going to go to Dunkin' for a low-calorie sandwich, but maybe people will. We have such a strange relationship with donuts. In fact, there's a new book about the history of the donut. It's called Glazed America, and the author is Paul Mullins. Paul, how do people look at donuts in this country?
Well, for some of the people that I talk to, over the time I did the book, there are folks that believed very strongly that donuts were the holy grail. And then on the other hand, there were people that thought donuts were the worst food on the face of the planet.
Well, how many of those people that said they hate donuts were actually eating a donut when they said that?
A lot of them, you're right. That's one of the kind of interesting contradictions, is that even when people go to the donut shop, sometimes they'll have misgivings, whereas they might go to a coffee shop and drink a rich double latte with vastly more calories, actually, than a donut, and not feel as equally conflicted about them. So donuts are often taken as a sort of symbolic stand-in for all the evil foods that we consume.
That's really interesting. So what happens to donut sales in a down economy?
Well, the conventional logic is that donuts are sort of inverse mirror of the economy. So, for instance, during times of recession, folks in the industry argue that donut sales generally will increase because we're pinching pennies. You can eat a very filling snack or meal, you know, at a donut shop for very little money. Donut chains are doing actually quite well right now.
Well, let's talk about the donut chains. Who's winning the donut war, Krispy Kreme or Dunkin'?
Dunkin' is certainly profiting much more and making a whole lot more money right now than Krispy Kreme. On another level, though, Krispy Kreme has been very stable. There's a much, much smaller number of Krispy Kremes out there, but they do in very, very good PR. So they have a kind of cachet to them.
All right, Paul, what's your favorite donut?
I'm a fan of Super Sweet Donuts as a Southerner. And there's a donut shop here in Indianapolis, Long's Bakery, that makes a very, very sweet vanilla-filled donut that's really superb.
I cast my vote for Tim Horton's Canadian Maple Donut.
They're delightful, actually. Tim Horton is a very distinctive flavor. It's a niche that's not really very well covered by American donut makers.
Paul Mullins, he's the author of Glazed America. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
In Los Angeles, which has 1,600 donut shops, I'm Scott J. Gow. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.